Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week, and we are so lucky to have him, is Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Welcome, Jesse.
How are you, Alan?
Well, I'm okay. Now, you have done some fabulous work lately on the question of Andrew Cuomo and some emails. Could you tell us about that story?
Well, this was the result of actually a long process. About 2 years ago, right after the Prococo case started to break news, myself and Vivian Yee, who's a colleague of mine, yep, and at that point was in Albany, filed just kind of a very standard FOIL request asking for email correspondence, which might involve Joe Prococo, might involve Jim Malatrus, who was the director of state operations, and a couple other officials, as well as Todd Howe, who turned out to be the kind of disgraced lobbyist, yeah, at the heart of all these corruption cases. And in the course of fighting for these documents, we ended up in kind of a nasty legal skirmish with the Cuomo administration, which took us 2 years and cost the taxpayers of the state of New York over $200,000 to fight. We won that case. And then in settlement talks, we're eventually able to get most of the documents that we had sought. And then the story that we ran just earlier reflects about 350 pages of documents that they eventually provided to us, which basically showed that despite the governor's protestations that Todd Howe was not really known to him, was not really close to his administration, that he was an outlier, the emails that we discovered show a very different picture, that Todd Howe was, in fact, in contact with senior Cuomo administration officials for years at a time on a variety of topics, on topics ranging from storm recovery, you know, from topics involving payments going out to some of the developers who were at the heart of these corruption cases, and very often dealing with how the governor himself was being perceived. And one of the things you see in these emails is Todd Howe consistently worrying about how the governor's coming off, which indicates not only that he cared about the governor's reputation, but also cared that the governor would want him to safeguard it, you know, that somehow Todd Howe would be responsible for these things, all of which despite the fact that Todd Howe was not a member of the state government. He was just a lobbyist.
Now, let's remember that the so-called third brother, which we've all talked about ad nauseum, Joe Prococo, was convicted, and one of the guys who testified against him, of course, was Todd Howe, yep, but whose reputation was less than sterling. So it was unclear whether or not his testifying was actually helpful to the prosecution, you know, or not. But in the end, Jesse McKinley, it's all about pay to play, isn't it?
Well, that's debatable. I mean, the federal prosecutors would certainly say that there were donations that were given to Andrew Cuomo that were legal. And they emphasize, and we have emphasized in our coverage again and again, that the governor's never been accused of any wrongdoing. Now, that being said, in both of these cases, the Joe Prococo case and the Elaine Calleras case, even more prominently, what we're talking about is millions upon millions of dollars of state contracts and dealings behind closed doors to either bid rig those contracts or to use influence of Joe Prococo's or Elaine Calleras to help out people, you know, behind closed doors, right? That these deals were being cut outside of the public eye without transparency, and oftentimes in Joe Prococo's case for straight up bribes, in Elaine Calleras' case, in order to kind of burnish his reputation and prevent him from getting fired, which apparently was his great concern. And so I think that's really that was the heart of both of these corruption cases, was dealings going on outside the public eye, outside of the purview of regular state processes. And we were not talking small money here. I mean, in the case of that Buffalo Billion case, it was a $750 million contract, which I think is the largest contract that has been issued during Cuomo's 7+ years in office. And it was bid rigged. You know, it was straight up bid rigged. And prosecutors showed that, and they got the conviction as a result. So I wouldn't call it necessarily pay to play, but it was certainly unseemly.
So doesn't Andrew, look, you're a reporter, you're a brilliant guy, you graduated from NYU. So the question that I have is this. Andrew Cuomo comes into town, he runs for political office for the first time, and he says, I'm going to clean up the swamp. I'm going to clean up Albany. And he doesn't. The guys around him are out and out crooks. And you've been doing spectacular work, you know, in documenting some of this stuff. But still, he's 30 points out ahead in the last poll we saw. And you wonder, how can a guy who's presiding over basically this endemic corruption and being so popular?
Well, it's funny. I was reading something this morning by a colleague, Jeff Mays, where, you know, it shows that if you look at the polling on this, corruption continually, if you ask New York voters what upsets them, what the issues they are concerned about, you know, corruption's almost always at the top of the list. You know, I think I read this morning that Siena had it at 85% of New York voters are very upset about corruption. And yet, when it comes down to the votes, when it comes down to elections, that issue does not seem to really get people voted out of office. The lawmakers and the state officials who end up out of office as a result of corruption generally don't end up out of office because they get voted out. They end up out of office because they get convicted, you know, because they end up going to the pokey. You know, this is not an issue that seems to galvanize voters to get rid, you know, throw the bums out. You know, that has not seemed to be a potent political issue yet.
So I have this theory, Jesse McKinley, that the Cuomo name, Mario Cuomo, is still so magic in New York that people, when they vote, they say, well, I know the father and the son must be like the father. It's very vague, but that's why I'm going to support him. I don't know these other people.
I don't think that's a bad theory at all. And I also would argue that in the case of his primary opponent, people may not want to vote for a Nixon. You know, that's not exactly a flattering name.
You're talking about Cynthia Nixon, the actress who's running against him in the primary.
Yeah, and, you know, Tricky Dick didn't do that last name any favors. So maybe Cynthia's being hurt by that as well. You know, I think also that for voters, and you talk about this 30-point lead, I think there is a perception amongst a lot of voters that Andrew Cuomo's done a pretty good job, you know, that while there has been corruption that has surrounded his administration, that he has a list of accomplishments that he is able to run on, you know, things like same-sex marriage and paid family leave and keeping the budget in check and, you know, property tax caps and bringing the budgets in on time. And, you know, these are bona fide accomplishments that he is able to run on. And moreover, because he has so much money in the bank, you know, $31 million, that buys a lot of TV ads. He is able to amplify that message again and again and again. And then couple that with the powers of incumbency, with the fact that he's able to hold state-funded events that sometimes look a lot like campaign events, but far be it for me to cast aspersions. But still, he is able to get on the TV and or the radio every day and amplify the message that he's doing a good job and give him 4 more years. And at the end of the day, that may drown out even the bad news, of which there has been a lot for him.
There sure has. I noticed that the Times did a very interesting thing. They endorsed your reporter as opposed to on the editorial board, but the Times did something that was extraordinary. They endorsed Ms. Teachout for the attorney general's spot. And I'm fascinated by that race because Cuomo has basically endorsed the number two person in New York, the public advocate, Letitia James. And she is now on somewhat of a defensive, having to go around and tell people that she's capable of holding Andrew Cuomo to account if she finds him doing something wrong. In other words, she feels compelled to do that because this seems to be the rap against her.
Yeah, I mean, that appears to be a much more competitive race. And, you know, there's 4 candidates. I think that all 4 of those candidates are credible contenders for that office. They all seem to be legitimately qualified. I think they all appeal to different segments of the electorate. And I think that in the case of Tish James, she will and has run into a little bit of, you know, what's the best metaphor? She both benefits by her connection with Andrew Cuomo and also has to deal with the baggage that he sometimes brings. And I think, you know, if you believe the polls right now in the gubernatorial primary, Cuomo should cruise, right? He's up by 30 points. But I think if you start to look at kind of smaller races, races where the margins may not be hundreds of thousands of votes, but maybe tens of thousands of votes, I think that's where you start to get white knuckle time if you are a mainstream Democrat. And I think you saw that in the Ocasio-Cortez race in Queens, where it did not take that many voters, that many kind of fired up grassroots voters, to tip that election to a relatively unknown 28-year-old who was speaking the right message at the right time when Joe Crowley was not. And I think in more local races, I think particularly in state Senate races, I think that, you know, a lot of the former IDC members, you know,
the Independent Democratic Conference.
Yeah, absolutely. Are probably pretty freaked out right now. I think that there are three or four of those races where the progressive, you know, quote, progressive left wing.
The Octavio Cortez.
Yeah, that kind of left wing of the party really seems to have the momentum and really seems to have the right look and the right touch right now. And some of those primaries are going to be squeakers, and some of those IDC candidates may very well lose. So I think in races where the margins are smaller, like the attorney general's race, where you're going to have four candidates kind of battling out for a set number, let's say 500,000 votes, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 votes that are going to get pushed by people voting against Cuomo and thus against Tish James, that could be problematic for her.
Well, you know, Jesse McKinley, the Ocasio-Cortez race is interesting in that I've always thought it's not only her left-wingism that made her popular, but also because she was more like the people in her district than Joe Crowley was.
For sure.
So what we call identity politics,
for
I
sure.
suppose. Now, I have a feeling that Andrew Cuomo thinks that since Ocasio-Cortez actually outperformed the polls by 50%, think about that, mm-hmm. 30% had her behind in the so-called Crowley poll that we knew, and she won by 15%.
Yep.
That's huge.
Yep.
So it's got to make everybody, including Andrew Cuomo, worried, doesn't it?
I think particularly right after it happened, it made him worry because I think that Andrew Cuomo shares a pollster with Joel Crowley. So
interesting.
So if he missed by 50%, you know, that's a pretty big miss.
I would say
that's not, you know, quite in the margin of most errors.
So is he running scared?
I don't think he's running scared right now. I think that there have been moments in the last 3 or 4 months since Cynthia Nixon got into this campaign when he was absolutely running scared, where there was a sense of, oh boy, what are we facing here? I think that he feels that he's probably stabilized the ship. I think he feels that the, you know, kind of novelty of Cynthia Nixon's candidacy may have worn off a little bit, that a lot of the kind of initial, oh my God, media attention that she was given has worn off a little bit. But we're basically 3 weeks out right now, and you never know. I mean, we're going to have a debate next week, which will be the only debate of this campaign. There can be landmines in debates, particularly for a politician like Andrew Cuomo, who, as evidenced by his statement last week about America not being that great or ever great or never great or whatever his exact wording was, that sort of gaffe can be costly, particularly in the closing stretches of a campaign.
So, particularly when you're dealing with a woman, and if you show any condescension, and you could hurt yourself.
Yeah, I mean, anything can happen. I think right now he's pretty confident, and I think that she's running out of time to kind of make her case. But we'll see after that debate. I mean, stranger things have certainly happened, as evidenced by what's happened in Washington.
Well, let's go back to the Times and Teach Out. That's a very interesting thing. New York Times is a Bible in New York City. You know, I grew up on the West Side. I know about the Times. I still get down there a lot. It's very interesting. So if the Times says Teach Out over the other people, you've got some flawed candidates there. You've got a guy from the Hudson Valley. It's not the five boroughs, which in a primary doesn't really count that much, Sean Patrick Maloney. And he's running for two political offices at the same time, although he would argue that he's not.
Well, I don't know the thinking of the editorial board, but I would agree that the Times probably has an outsized influence on some Democratic voters in that city. I think that, like many races in New York State, you live or die by New York City, right? Like that's where the votes are.
And well, I think, certainly in the case of the Democratic primary.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you know, that endorsement has been every morning when I open up my email box, there's something from Zephyr Teachout saying, hey, by the way, did you notice that we got endorsed by the New York Times? So they were obviously very excited about it. I think it gave them a good chance to raise money off that sort of endorsement because, you know, these races are not cheap. And you're right in that it will kind of come down to turnout and it will come down to who gets out. And also, we do have this strange little wrinkle that the primary is going to be on a Thursday this year rather than on a Tuesday because Tuesday was 9/11. So we'll see who is effective in getting their voters out. And that's where the race is going to be won or lost, I think, particularly in that AG's race.
Well, another candidate is Lisha Eve, who is the daughter of the legendary politician Arthur Eve from the Buffalo region. And I see that she's spending some real money on ads right now.
Yeah, and I think that she is a legitimate candidate. She's got a very strong resume with terms of service in both the Clinton and the Cuomo administration, both on a state and federal level. And I think that in another campaign season when perhaps the crowd wasn't quite as crowded, you know, she might be getting a little bit more attention. She's not particularly helped, I don't think, by the fact that she's kind of a Western New York candidate, and that makes it a little bit difficult for her to get, once again, the New York City eyes and attention from New York City media. But I certainly think that that she is a credible candidate. And I think to bring it home, I think that part of what we're seeing in this cycle is not only candidates that may be successful this time around, but we probably have not seen the end of Cynthia Nixon, I would guess. And I would, even if she loses the primary, which she is way behind in the polls, I think even if Lisha Eve gets beat in the attorney general's race, we may not have seen the end of her. And as evidenced by Zephyr Teachout running for governor in 2014 and now running for attorney general in 2018, I don't think we've seen the end of Zephyr Teachout even if she doesn't win. And I think the other interesting dynamic that is going on in this election cycle is the year of the women. You know, this is a year in which female candidates, I think, largely emboldened and infuriated by Donald Trump, are coming out. And moreover, they're not only coming out, they're winning. And I think that, if anything, is kind of one of the more kind of dangerous harbingers for Andrew Cuomo.
So if there's a blue wave, which I think there's going to be, I think there certainly will be a blue wave in New York City and New York State. I don't know if there will be for the rest of the country, but blue wave might well happen. What happens? I mean, is it possible, for example, that both houses of the state legislature, we know the assembly will, but the Senate goes overwhelmingly Democratic?
I don't know that overwhelmingly is possible. I think that a lot of those upstate Senate districts are pretty safely Republican. I think that what's always interesting for me covering New York state politics is, yes, this is a Democratic state. Yes, Democrats outnumber Republicans more than 2-1 in this state. That being said, there are swaths, and I mean counties, I mean hundreds of square miles in this state that are solidly, solidly Republican.
To say nothing about the gerrymander. Which
no, absolutely. And these are districts that people like Donald Trump, and they like Republican values, and they like Republican policies, and they dislike Andrew Cuomo. So as much as it seems like there's a blue wave that's going to just sweep over every single district and every single part of this fair land and fair country, blah, 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 you can say it however you want. That is divorced from reality of a lot of parts of the state where they don't vote blue. they vote Republican, and they will vote Republican again this fall.
Okay, so let's assume that the Senate, with the gerrymander, you said, as you said, 2-1 Democratic in New York, in New York State. Let's say the Senate goes Democratic. You know, what happens then? What difference will that make?
Well, let's play out the scenario that Andrew Cuomo is elected to a third term. Let's play out the scenario that the Democrats take the Senate. It'll be a curious set of circumstances because Cuomo has, for 7+ years, managed to play this very delicate high wire act whereby he has gotten a lot of progressive/liberal things done, but he has not had to do everything that a very left-leaning assembly has wanted to do. And the reason he hasn't had to do all those things is because he's had this bulwark with a Republican Senate. And, you know, spin whatever conspiracy theory you want, but he seems to have benefited by the fact that he has not had to do every single super duper lefty policy proposal that's come out of the Assembly.
As his father before him.
Exactly. And if, let's say, that the Senate does go Democratic, there will be much less of a break on, you know, more left-leaning policies that he may not want to do. He may not want to do universal health care because universal health care in the state of New York would be really expensive, and he may not want to bust a budget by doing something like that. There are other policies that he may simply not want to do because they are either seen as financially impossible or difficult, or politically difficult, would, you know, lean him too far left if he does want to run for president someday. So if he is given a Democratic Senate and a Democratic Assembly, which he will have an assembly, no doubt, if he's given that fully Democratic legislature, it's going to make it a little more difficult for him to not sign on to every single, you know, more left-leaning piece of policy that comes down the pike. And that's going to be a difficult balance for him because at his heart, Andrew Cuomo really has always operated in the political center. He is not a fire-breathing lefty. He is not a, you know, grassroots progressive. He is a centrist and a moderate who has run on this policy of pragmatism of getting things done. But some of the things that the Democratic Assembly and Senate may want to do are not things that he will want to get done.
Okay, I want to ask you real quickly about the Moral Endowment Commission. I think if he has one black eye, that's the big one. He set up a crime-fighting commission. He abolished the crime-fighting commission. And now a lot of people running for office want to start another Moral Endowment Commission. I'm wondering, how does he ever get over that?
How does he ever get over the initial Moral Endowment Commission?
Yes.
I mean, I think he has gotten over it. Right. I don't think it has not really been a lasting black mark, although he's got a lot of little bruises on him, but I don't think it's a black eye per se. But that is a classic example of the kind of left policy that might be initiated by a Democratic legislature or pushed for by Democratic advocates that he's not going to want to sign on to.
Okay, now he's also wants to set up this commission to basically find out if there's any wrongdoing among district attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that the feds are always prosecuting cases against New York politicians is they've always found a way to not have New York guys do it. David Soar is my friend, who is the head of the District Attorneys Association, is dead set against this happening. Thinks it's a bad idea. What do you think?
Well, I think they're going to file a lawsuit. I think DASNY, which David heads, has already indicated they're going to file a lawsuit. I talked to them less than 24 hours ago, and they said they are getting ready to file a lawsuit. They just want to see what this chapter amendment looks like. So that prosecutorial misconduct commission is going to start, with a lawsuit on its back, even if it gets set up by the legislature next year. So this is not going to be an easy topic to finesse for the administration or for the legislators that want it, you know.
Jesse McKinley of the New York Times, we are honored that you've given us this time this week. You're always invited back here, and we really thank you for the fine work you've been doing. You've been breaking great stories, and we follow them all the time.
Thanks so much.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.